You're listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent in Birmingham, Alabama, a church with a heart for the gospel. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.
All right, everyone, welcome to the Dean's class today. And I'm so delighted George is closing the door back there. And I'm sure others may come if they do. Thank you, Tom, very much. And you have a leaflet. I'm absolutely delighted to be in this setting. I feel I kept this last night, the old Four Tops classic, Standing in the Shadows of Love, kept coming to me because I thought about standing in the shoes of Craig and all those people who are here usually. But I'm most grateful for your coming, and I hope that you will find something helpful. The plan is to, I will speak, and there are some chairs up here, I will speak today for about half an hour, then we'll take Q&A, and then we'll finish for the 11 o'clock. And then next week, I will continue on a slightly different theme, but the same gut level application, I hope. But again, warmest welcome. I'll say a little prayer, like Aretha Franklin. Sorry, my mind, I don't know about you, I can't say anything without a song coming. It's just, it's so funny how that just happened. Dear God, speak to me, and therefore that I can speak to your family here, for the sake of Christ our Lord. Amen.
Amen.
Now, the handout is a series of three from left to right. There were memes that I composed about 2 months ago to epigrammatically sum up the Christian faith as I was seeing it then. I had no plan of being in Birmingham when I wrote these. They were kind of an attempt, partly for Mockingbird Ministries, to sum up. Gosh, when I look, I see so many familiar faces that I sort of want to cry when I see a lot of individuals there, because there's a story attached to all of us. Remember that Naked City, the old television show from the 60s? There are 8 million stories in the Naked City, and you are one of them. These memes were an attempt to summarize or condense the heart of the Christian faith as I see it or experience it today. They weren't intended to be didactic. They were intended more to be an exercise. And there's one other, which I've left out because it's a little more horizontal. But these three statements sum up the Christian depth as I currently understand it. And I'm going to go through them briefly and then apply them to the three phases of life. Now, that sounds like a lot, and it'll be a little concentrated, but we'll end in plenty of time, and we'll have time for discussion. In other words, these are three summations of the Christian conviction, and then I'm going to apply them to childhood, which I would call formation, and to adulthood, which I might call engagement, and the last third of life, resolution. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take these three and see how they pan out very briefly and sort of rubrically to the where you are. Now, I'm obviously, when I was here at the Advent, my numero uno field of concern was people who were in the second phase of life. All the families and individuals and people, by definition, as they still exist in great large numbers, who are involved in engagement. The child has become a man, to use the old phrase, but the child is also father of the man. But the engagement was where I was primarily, and I was with Mary. We brought up our three children right here. And they are all preaching this morning at this moment in different places in the United States, literally. Mary was in the car streaming John Zoll teaching this morning from Bedford, New York, and I said, your priorities are wrong. But anyway, the that was the overwhelming care, because we ourselves were in the second phase of life. So obviously, we connect with people, contemporaries, in the phase of children and schooling and sports and triathlons and problems. And but now, at a different phase of life, I'm personally, I'm still very concerned for those who are in the second phase, like our kids. But I'm interested for myself, quite personally, in resolution and looking back over one's life of childhood and then engagement. Now let's look, just for a minute, at these three memes. And I'll comment very briefly on each one. This is the, Christianity is not a metaphor. The gospel is not a metaphor, because it actually is based on something that happened, and it is also active in real life. It's not simply a parable, although it has to be often expressed parabolically or in a metaphor. And the first meme is this. God's grace makes a second chance always possible. There is no condition or situation in life for which this is not true. Now, this is the most important of all Christian affirmations about life, that a second chance is always possible, and there is no condition or situation for which this is not true. And of course, the trouble is, we believe it, many of us believe it, but there is always a condition or situation in life for which this is not true. Unfaithfulness on the part of someone you love. A child getting so far gone that you just have to write them off. That rarely happens. Things in your own professional life for which there appears to be an utter dead end. Closed doors. And so the radicality of this has to be underlined. Years ago, when Tully Antevigian got into such trouble, he was universally made a leper because of his own sin, which he acknowledged. Universally, not a single colleague in the formal church of which he was a minister came forward with the hope that there might be a second chance possible. It's one of the most extraordinary, eye-opening experiences I ever had, when obviously, as far as the church was concerned, there was a situation in which Tullian could not be offered a second chance. And I protested that. The second meme is, God always seems to respond to a small step of faith on our part. This is a description, not a prescription. Now, I used to not believe that as much as I do. I was tending to think that God had to do it all, and he does do it all. But funnily enough, in practice, it seems like a small step of faith is kind of required to move ahead. I almost wish it weren't true. But I find just, and notice I say, it's a description, not a prescription. I'm not telling you to have faith, where right now all you see is bleakness, or all you see is shadow, or all you see is things that stubbornly won't give way in any part of your life. But I would also say, if you ever find yourself just with a mustard seed of faith, that seems to create a kind of second law of thermodynamics in which God always responds. I can't quite put it theologically into Reformed terms, but I can put it in experiential terms. And by the way, go out and immediately see a little movie called Little Boy from 2015. It was a Mexican-American major production made in 2015 about how a little boy in a small California town, and dismiss the first 40 minutes of the movie. It's Hallmark cards. It's the Hallmark Channel gone maniacally on steroids. But stay with it. It is so radical, the movie, Little Boy from 2015, that the Village Voice dedicated an entire page to attacking it, because it's about how a little boy making one step of faith on behalf of an absent father changes the course of world history purely from a Christian angle. And the movie is radical, beyond radical. But that's, I'm sure you've found this when you've been in a darkness, that at some moment you saw the possibility of hope, and it did in fact change everything. The third of these three memes is the one that relates perhaps more to people who are sort of a little older, but don't dismiss it if you're not. If the great challenge of life is assimilating its negativities, the resolution is found in seeing the loving hand of God in all things. Now, what happens in later life is that you may have satisfaction, peace of mind, serenity, calm, about 95% of what's happened to you, or perhaps 70% if it's been a bad run. But even the best of us, at the end, there's a sore thumb. My experience is, even with the best of us, there is something unresolved, often from the distant past. I saw this once, twice with men who were at the very, very end of their lives, and they were could no longer speak, but they were within a few hours of their death, but they were still sharp. Their mind was still going. And in two different cases, I saw a look of such panic, profound, heartfelt terror in the eyes of these two wonderful people whom I had known well. It made a very great impression. And then I think I told you once that I was in Ossining, New York, and I was the low church sort of Episcopalian rector, and there was a very, very high church rector, impossible person. He was the rector of a church in Ossining to which John Cheever had gone. He'd left my church to go to that church. I was called to his bedside in the hospital in Tarrytown, and he had the most extraordinary request, because he was difficult and captious and very sort of telling you what to do all the time. And he said, close the door. He was in intensive care. I don't want my wife in here or any of my children. And he proceeded to tell me something about his life that was so unbelievable, that was so extreme, and that was so, I can't believe, you know, something that had happened 45 years earlier, that I realized that this man had been sitting on it for 45 years. He then told me what it was, and I've never told a soul and never will, including his nearest and dearest, what it was. And I pronounced absolution, confession and absolution. And he sank back in his bed, and an hour later, his wife called me from the ICU to say that her husband had died. And I learned something. This man had been harboring something. Now, it was extreme. You're not harboring anything extreme. Sure. No. But believe me, there are things that you see this in all Westerns. Remember all Westerns when a guy would get shot and they'd say, who was it? What happened? It was. Or, you know, tell Laura I. But it's uniform. But the trouble is that's a poetic picture of what actually happens to many people. So I'm interested in how it would be possible for a person to find resolution in life in the last third, such that I could, to quote this, assimilate the negativities by means of seeing the loving hand of God in all things. Now, that's a radical statement. Because somebody could say, well, I didn't see the loving hand of God in my child's psychiatric illness. I didn't see the loving hand of God when someone I loved was suddenly died in their sleep. I don't see that, and I understand that. But I will also tell her or him that the only resolution you'll have is something like assimilation of the negativity. Now, you're with me. Those are the three memes. Now, to talk about, and you might ask yourself, which one of them applies to me today most? You know, does one of them speak to me? A second chance, need for a small step of faith, maybe I'm harboring something that is preventing my peace and happiness in the now. Think about that. Now, I want to apply these briefly to a human life. I want to just say how this actually works. Now, in the case of children, what have I given? I've given three the words from God as I see them. Now we're going to briefly apply them to the different phases of a human life. Now the first phase is being a child. And in a funny kind of way, none of them apply to being a small child. Because a small child doesn't have any way of, there's no backlog. There's no content. The small child is entirely in the now. Now, he or she gets wasted easily and troubled and formed. But formation is something to which none of these apply, and yet all of them apply. So what you do with children, and it was so well done and is so well done here at the Church of the Advent, I believe it's done here as well as any place that I know. You follow the advice of Crosby, Stills, and Nash & Young. You teach your children well. You remember that song? Spring of 1969, Sandy immediately got it. What you do is, with all the love in the world, all the grace in the world, and all the mercy in the world, you give your child a foundation. And to this day, I've never seen a more panoramic team of conscientious, loving formation than that of Miriam Morris, Fran Cade, and Frau Lankford. I never saw it, and I know you have it now. So the first phase of human life, they don't apply, and they all apply. So that's why all of them should play some kind of sword drill in which they memorize these, because these will come back to them when they're in prison. They will come back to them when they have been deserted by someone they deeply cared about or thought they knew. This will come back to them when a job that they had longed for and hoped for, a partnership that finally came in, was suddenly terribly, terribly threatened. So the first phase of life is one of formation. Teach your children well. Now, the second phase of life is engagement. Now, this is you. I'm talking about you. Now, you may say, oh, that's not my experience. Well, you can think about that, if it may be or may not be. You were a child, and then you took a photograph of your child, and all of a sudden they were not a child anymore for whatever reason. I hate to see our grandchildren grow up. I just hate it. I just hate when I see grandchildren, especially granddaughters, turn into teenagers. I just can't stand it. Now, that's Freudian. But the thing about engagement, what happens is that the child, his self, now engages with the external world. And that's where he needs the first two, because he's going to need a second chance if it's just with a girlfriend when he's 15. She's going to need a chance when she goes to New York after college and it doesn't work out. They're going to need a second chance when one of their children is diagnosed with a serious inherited or other condition. They're going to get a second chance. A very close friend of mine's entire life was fundamentally determined when he was expelled from the fancy Episcopal school he went to in his 11th grade year. He has never recovered from it when he was expelled. Now, that's where he would need to hear that a second chance is possible. He never heard it. So he's still, in 1967, in the headmaster's study, being told he was expelled for adolescent rage. That really helped him with rage. And but similarly, a small step of faith. Now, I want to read something about adulthood. We're doing fine with time, I can tell. I'm going to read something about adulthood, engagement. And it's the phase where most people who we are in. And you might even be in it later, but you're really probably not. And if you want to have fun this afternoon, go on the internet and find a short story by Charles Dickens called The Child's Story. Dickens wrote four Christmas novellas, but he also wrote about 20 Christmas short stories. And this is a short story of about 6 pages, a Christmas story called The Child's Story. And in it, the soul of a man kind of comes and interviews the man at each of the three phases of life. The child with his wonder and his living in the present and everything is magical and he runs and all that and he sees that. But then he meets the adult, and this is Charles Dickens' description of what happens when he meets the adult. The traveler, who is the soul, lost the children one day, and after calling them to come back, which they never did, went on upon his journey. So he went on for a little while without seeing anything, till at last he came to a 30 or 40 year old aged gentleman. So he said to the gentleman, "What are you doing here?" And the answer was, "I am always busy. Come and be busy with me." So he, the soul, began to be very busy with that gentleman, and they went on through the whole wood. Then three children die. One child leaves. This is the empty nest. They came to several avenues, and one of the children said, of the busy man with his wife, "Father, I'm going to sea." And another said, "Father, I'm going to India." And another said, "Father, I'm going to seek my fortune." And another said, "Father, I'm going to heaven." Whenever these partings happened, the traveler looked at the gentleman and saw him glance up at the sky above the trees where the day was beginning to decline, but they never could rest, for they had their journey to perform, and it was necessary for them to be always busy. Now, I think that's one of the most, the German word for it is dick, concentrated, condensed pictures of the life that most people, and very much including myself, live. Busy. It has different forms for everybody, but notice that the soul, it doesn't have content. It's more a style of life than a contentual life. And so I'm not wiping my feet on it, because you're looking at the ultimate busy person. All I ever wanted to do was get a professional emolument, a promotion. I thought for 30 years I would become the dean of the Washington Cathedral. Fat chance. But that was my idea. You've had some idea. Didn't you have an idea like that? Or maybe I'd become the minister of some Ivy League university that I lusted after. And it until I got the perfect job out of the blue, which happened to be the Church of the Advent in Birmingham. But think of how when you look back upon your years of engagement, even now, it doesn't... Don't you feel it's getting relativized? I mean, it's not, I'm not negating it. I mean, I could negate my life climbing whatever, doing all these. I mean, how many baseball games did we go in Charleston, South Carolina? No batter. I mean, how many did I play a role of a father interested in baseball for years and years? Busy, and with Jim Palmer, with Simeon, going down to Troy State. I think it's now called Troy State Heavenly University or something, big title. But we would go down to Dothan, Alabama, and week after week after week, screaming for our son and his relays, and it was the most wonderful thing in the world. I don't deny it at all. But for some reason, at this point, it feels a little relativized. That's all the word. I wouldn't say negated. I would say slightly relativized. Because when I'm in the hospital at, St. Vincent's Ascension and St. Vincent's, I'm going to probably, I'll probably almost forget the name of the town. I'll never forget the love that I have for the child, but I'm almost certain I'll forget the details. So engagement is the second, and that kind of relativizes or gets negated. Let's say relativizes. Now let's get to the third, and I'm over. The third phase, and this is one that means a lot to me, and it may not mean much to you, but it might possibly mean something to you. The third phase is resolution, especially vis-a-vis the past. I told you about how so often you meet somebody. Well, let me give you an example. There's an American playwright named John Anderson who wrote a lot of wonderful plays in the 50s, and one of them... his plays had to do with, let me get the link here. He constantly would it was called I Never Sang for My Father. And the movie, which won an Oscar, starred Gene Hackman and Melvin Douglas. And it's about a guy who's about 35, played by Gene Hackman, who's dealing with an impossible father, full of latent aggro, retired father, full of empowered falsehood, but nevertheless, I never sang for my father. And as the mother dies and the father is left alone as a widower, and the son goes dutifully to visit his old father. In the movie, I never sang for my father. And suddenly, out of Melvin Douglas's mouth, comes a memory that no one has ever heard about. He said, well, I never told you about the da 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 da. And here's the son who's 40 and very smart and wily and has girlfriends and wives and children and everything. And he's completely undone. His father's 84. And his father comes out with this narrative of something that happened that is a total surprise. Now, that man, the old man, dies unresolved. It's not that he has to go through some big fancy, you know, catharsis, but he has to tell somebody about this thing that has obviously monopolized his inward attention for 40 years, and he needs to at least be heard. He needs to be understood. And so the assimilation of past life is, I would say, indispensable. It's not an optional extra. And if you don't have it, you will die like Melvin Douglas. And that sounds dire. You will not. You could die like Melvin Douglas. So I want to finish by saying how Mary and I have sort of ourselves applied this a little bit to ourselves. First, God's grace make a second chance. Well, we've been very struck by a line for many years in the Four Quartets by T.S. Eliot. And the line is, old men ought to be explorers. Write that down. It's one of the great lines in modern poetry. Old men, he obviously means women. I mean, it's generic. Old men, he writes in 1924, old men ought to be explorers. And I remembered seeing that and saying to Mary, but that's the opposite of the way one feels. I want to go home and watch. You know what I really like to do? I haven't even told Mary this, but it's not a problem. I want to watch old episodes of The Invaders. Do you remember there was a show in 1966 with Roy Thinnes called The Invaders about a guy who was the only person in America who knew that the aliens were invading? And I just think that show is the greatest show in the history of television. And Mary, can you imagine how much Mary would just be thrilled to watch episodes of The Invaders? But that's not what T.S. Eliot says. He says, old men ought to be explorers. And I guess that's probably why we are in Birmingham. I think we heard that word in its own way from our children mainly. And that's why Mary is now studying officially to become a certified spiritual director with retreats, especially in New England, but she's here. And she's giving herself to a whole new academic course for the purpose of becoming a spiritual director in the sort of Ignatian tradition. That is giving her a freshness and an interest in service that is T.S. Eliot's maxim. For me, it's a little bit more, The Invaders is still a real temptation, but I do want to know, I'm here and I'm glad to be here, and it's all part of that, and it's possible for you. It's possible for you, because a second chance is always possible. A second thing, the step of faith. I saw it with Mary in her course of study. We might even have seen it in packing a car to come here, and with very few things, whatever you want to say. But think about if you're at an age when you're sort of losing hope in practical terms. You know, maybe walking is hard for you, or some other thing you used to love to do, or playing golf is not as easy as it used to be, or tennis is ruled out, or whatever it is. It may be that talking to God about that and saying, is there something that I could find enjoyable and even purposeful? He's never let me down yet. And I can say that looking you straight in the eye. When I prayed that kind of prayer, I've never not heard an answer, ever. It may not have come, you know, in 5 seconds, but it's almost always come during the day. I was looking for a parking place somewhere very hard to find, known as Birmingham, the other day, because I wanted to go to a bookshop, and I knew that I would be towed because they have new rules downtown, so I was a little nervous about it. And I finally just said, Lord, I know I'm not supposed to pray for a parking place, but will you please give me a parking place? And then that second, somebody pulled out in front of the store I was going to. Now, you may say that's naive, but it's happened too many times for me to rule it out. And the third thing is resolution. I would say that it is very worthwhile to look at the course of your human experience. And if there is, in fact, an unresolved relationship, I'm talking about whether you're 40 or whether you're 60 or whether you're 85, it's meant to be resolved, because it will come back. It just empirically, it's an observation. You can say, oh, I mapped, everything's great. I've mapped everything out, totally fine. But then some guy will be at your bedside and wherever in the hospital, and you'll have an irresistible urge to say something. And you don't even know where it came from. These are physical laws of life. There are things inside people that are like physical laws. It's got to come out in some form. So if it could only come out in the form of a Christian confession, cum honest exchange in the open before God, it would be an enormous burden lifted from almost anybody who's at that phase of life. Now, thank you for listening. And I wonder if there might be a few questions or comments about this material. That's Coffee Colvin.
It appears to me, Paul, that there would be a very strong link between the second and the third phase, in that your personality, your beliefs, your whole life's experience is wrapped up in those two periods. I mean, you've got the learning period.
Yep.
But then you've got the period where you apply your learning to your life, and then it progresses into the resolution.
Yes.
And those two seem to me to be extremely closely linked. It'd be hard to really separate them.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I would say they are organically linked. For the Christian, they are organically linked, because inevitably the fresh start comes from a small step of faith. We all have examples. I mean, I could sit here and give you my examples and they would draw attention to me. I'd rather hear your example. But there was a time when you were faced with an impossible situation and the thought came to you, hey, maybe if I could call so-and-so. Or the thought came to you, maybe if I could just go to that particular place, I might hear something. And inevitably when you did, the beginning of the new beginning happened. So I'm really a big one on second chances and the connection with the small step of faith, which I'm not telling you to have, but I'm asking you to monitor it when it comes. And thirdly, finally, I've often dealt with people who had a terrible loss and have left their relationship with God because they say, and it's an intellectualization, I cannot believe in a God who would allow this to happen to someone that I loved. And I understand it. I mean, as Frank Lake used to say, I don't believe in him either. Frank Lake always surprised all the death row prisoners he would visit, our long dead English psychiatrist chaplain friend, when he would agree with the prisoner. But what I then found out is that in the long view of life, it's very often you suddenly find yourself realizing that even a calamitous situation, actually looking at the long haul, seem to have evoked in you or somebody else something very, very important and fresh. And I can certainly give you examples of that. Another question or comment? I can't quite see who that is. Oh, yes, what is your question? Because of my hearing aids, it's a terrible thing. I have to come a little closer.
Can you articulate how your Christology comes into play in each of these three?
Well, that's a very good question. There's nothing funny about that question. We used to say, or I coined this phrase, the higher your anthropology, the lower your soteriology. Now, I'm not finished. In other words, the more positive view you take of the human condition, the less important you feel salvation is, because there's not that much to be saved from. But then I elaborated on that to say the Christ is the essence of the soteriology. So if you have a low view of human nature, you need Christ. You need his saving work. If you have a high view of human nature, then Christianity becomes simply social action and horizontality. I grew up in the Episcopal Church where faith was almost entirely a horizontal matter of doing good works for the community and looking good, especially if you were wealthy. That was the way it really was. And when in my own life, and you may know this, you become confronted with sin, just the human tendency to not do that which I would do, Romans 7, you then suddenly find that Christianity, the gospel, is a vertical phenomenon and we need it. And I'll just give you one other example. We've taken many groups to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. Probably many people here have been to that most sacred place in world Christianity. Mary and I have taken many groups, including all our children and one of them who was in the womb, and who's now giving a sermon at a church in Bedford, New York. But we were got there, and I have never met a single person, this is to answer your question, who walked into the front door of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, who didn't almost instantly burst into tears. Not one. Not one. There was one person in the Advent who was quite indefatigably impermeable. A person I adored, a lovely lady, a person I adored, but she was pretty not permeable. And I had my one little prayer was that if I could only help her to come with me to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. You literally can't walk in it without being totally overcome by the sacrifice and the gift of Christ on the cross, because it's actually there. I mean, the rending of the cloth. So that's all I would say. This depends on what you drew attention to. Oh, maybe one other question, and then we'll finish. Or comment.
That's how Joss and I felt when we went to Cobia.
So when you went
where? In Normandy, and you just walk into the, you know, see that ocean of crosses looking, you know, they died, those guys died.
Yes.
In 3 hours to liberate a country they'd never seen before. The tears just start flowing without even, just spontaneous.
Jim, that's the moment you walked into that remarkable place. You immediately, and just think, that tells you that we are susceptible to love, because that's what it's really about. It's sacrifice. It's overwhelming. And I would say that when you're confronted with what Jesus did historically, and I've been there a lot, and I feel it very strongly, but it's also true, as I'll say next week, when you're confronted with love that you don't deserve from someone who is truly wonderful. Now, Jim is not nodding his head. No, just kidding. He's nodding. When you're confronted with love from someone wonderful whom you do not deserve in any conscious way, that will automatically reduce a normal human being to love and the response of emotional desire to return the love. And that's what we'll talk about next week. I think it's time to finish, but thank you so much for coming. I'll be here next week.
You've been listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent. If you live in Birmingham or find yourself visiting, we hope you'll join us for one of our Sunday services. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.